This is our third session of our Great Controversies in Jewish History course. Again, we thank the family of Gloria Fremen, Zichrona Livracha, who have sponsored our class. All of the learning that we do should be an aliyah for the neshama as we spread so much to learn from Jewish history. The topic that we're going to address tonight, false messiahs. There is a series of them which take place in the 16th and 17th centuries. And besides for the story of the false messiahs themselves, of which there are three that we need to cover, we'll do two of them tonight, David Haru Uveni and Shabtai Tzvi. Of course, Shabtai Tzvi is the much more famous of the two. Interwoven into the stories are really the ideas behind them, the principles that allowed for these stories to take place amongst the Jewish people. Because the names might change, the names which took place, the stories of the 17th, 16th, and 17th centuries, but what's going on amongst the Jewish people is timeless. That always, people are people, and we remain with the same things. And so the issues that we have to learn about remains. Now, we are no strangers to false messiahs. The Jewish people are no strangers. We have two of the most famous, and our people, of course, are... You don't have to mention his name. Okay, Jesus of Nazareth is, of course, probably the most famous of all the false messiahs amongst... You can tell Rabbi Miller, I quoted him. I once told him that he was, for those of you... He was here. Now the Babatur. Get out of here. Get out of here. Come on. We will touch on Chabad a little bit later. But Jesus, of course, is the most famous of all of the false messiahs. And the other famous one is... No. He's not a false... He's not one of our false messiahs. Come on. Thank you, on Zoom, Bar Kokhba. Both of those, the Bar Kokhba, who Rabbi Akiva, the great Rabbi Akiva himself, believed Bar Kokhba. I can't read the names. I'm not close enough. Rabbi Akiva himself thought Bar Kokhba was going to be the Mashiach and redeem the Jewish people. And now, whether or not the Jews ever believed in Jesus is a historical debate. Not for now. It's unlikely. That was really a whole different thing. But the concept of false messiahs, therefore, we're familiar with. And we had a very negative reaction. Both of those two take place within around the turn of the millennium, around the year zero. And Bar Kokhba was around the 130, 140 Common Era. So, but for the next 1,400 years, the Jews are like, we're not into it. Like, we had a very bad experience, and nothing really, no major players arise for a long time, 1,400 years. And then in the 1,500, 1,600, 1,700, there's a slew of them. And that really is where our discussion is. What's going on amongst the Jewish people that our defense system, our immunity to this, sort of falls away during this period of time? Yeah, obviously, and it'll have to do with some of the major events going on. And many of the things that we have in the world today are a result of them, so we will cover all of these things. Okay, a couple of points. So the boxes in your notes are like, I have like seven of them. We'll sort of we'll weave these truths or concepts into our story, but there are a few that we have to start with. The first one that we have to start with is really even before we get started. The prequel, if you will, is who says there's going to be a Mashiach at all? Where is this concept that there will be a Mashiach to come and redeem the Jewish people? So if you flip to the back, your last sheet, number four, the addendum, I don't want to spend time because this is not a class on Mashiach, but the Rambam writes very clearly in the very beginning, at the end, excuse me, of his Hilchos Malachim, anyone who does not believe in him, that's a lowercase m, right? Anyone who does not believe in a concept of a Mashiach or does not await his coming denies not only the statements of the other prophets, but those of the Torah and of Moshe Rabbeinu. The Torah testifies to his coming. Pasuk of Hashem will be Vishav Hashem and Shavuos Hashem will bring you back from your captivity. He will gather you from amongst the nation. And even if you're Mikatzeh, right? We say this every Shabbos. You're on the ends of the earth. Hashem is going to bring you all back. These explicit words of the Torah include all the statements of all the Nevi'im. So the Rambam sets it up as a fundamental tenet of faith that there is such a concept. There will be a Mashiach. It's one of the Yud Gimel Ikari HaEmunah. The Rambam's 13 principles of Ani Ma'amim BeEmunah Shalema BeVias a Mashiach. There's such a concept. And a Jew who does not believe in that concept, who does not believe that there will be a redeemer of flesh and blood, a human being who comes and will redeem the Jewish people, is outside the purview of Jewish thought. It's one of the 13 principles of faith the Rambam writes, and he writes very strongly that it's the Torah Nevi'im, it's there. Now that leads us to, not only does a Jew have to believe in the concept of Mashiach, Not only do we have that, but box number one is yearning for the redemption is a fundamental component of our belief system. It's not just enough to know that it's going to happen, but that a Jew is obligated to yearn for it, to think about it, to want it, to wish it to come. This is summarized back on your addendum in oft-quoted, very important Gemara Masechta Shabbos. The Gemara says, you know, everybody's going to die. It's going to happen. There's no person who's lived forever. And when we die, the Gemara says, they're going to ask us six questions in the heavenly court as we arrive before the heavenly court at the end of our life. Now, this doesn't mean it's an easy test just because you know the questions in advance. But the Gemara tells you the questions in advance. Here's what you're going to have to answer. Now live your life in preparation to answer these six questions. The Gemara tells us what they are. The Gemara tells us without, we don't spend much time because again, there's not all. Now, did you act in good faith in your dealings with others? Were you honest? Question number one, the first question you get up to Shemayim, were you honest? Did you set aside fixed times for Torah study? And they're not going to ask if you're a Talmud Chacham. They're going to ask, did you have a set time? Did you learn a little bit every day? Did you attempt to fulfill Peru Urvu? Number four, did you yearn for the redemption? On the questions that we're going to be asked, every single person at the end of our life in this world is going to be, did you yearn for the redemption? Yes, you were living in whatever period of 2,000 years of exile, but did you yearn to go home? Did you think about it? Did you think about maybe making plans? Did you wish? Did you just wait? Did you yearn for redemption? So we are a people who not only believe in redemption as a fundamental tenet, but that we have to yearn for it, which means almost every day, that's the end of that Rambam we started. Not only animam in bevias haMashiach, but afal pi sheyisma hameya, even though he delays, chol yom, every day, I'm waiting, I'm yearning, I'm thinking, that's what I want. I want it to come. So we have these first two. Now one more that we have to add, and that is, not only do we believe in it and we yearn for it, but box number two, we have no idea when it's going to happen. So that, which really creates quite a people of yearning for something with no understanding, and purposely we have not been told when he's coming or any reliable means to figure that out. And that is also, just so on back to your addendum, the Rambam in source number three, the Rambam writes, these things were purposely left ambiguous by the Nevi'im. Chazal also do not have any clear tradition and can only come, they have all sorts of conclusions, they try to darshan this pasuk or that pasuk. We have many, many interpreters, many understand. We don't have any definitive understanding as to when it's going to happen. Not only do we not have any understanding when it's going to happen, Chazal curse anyone who tries to figure it out. The Gemara Masechta Sanhedrin, source number four, Meshul Bar Nachmeni, may the very essence of those who calculate the end suffer agony. The Gemara puts a curse on anyone who tries to calculate and tell us when it's going to happen. And the Gemara says, why? Because if you give us a date, and then the date comes and goes and nothing happened, so then everybody loses hope, they become despondent, and they say, it's never going to happen, you just wait. Meanwhile, despite the fact that the Gemara says it was purposely left vague, despite the fact that Gemara curses anyone who makes an attempt, throughout the centuries, great Jews, like the Rambam, after writing, don't calculate, he then gives us this calculation as to when he thinks it's going to happen. The Vilna Gaon had a calculation, the Malbim had a calculation, we've had literally a long list of Rabbanim, despite the fact that the Gemara says, like, don't do it, and it's like this urge, this insatiable urge to try to figure out when it's going to happen. Rabbi Wein uses the example, if you ever had the great pleasure, as we have when we lived in Atlanta for many years, of a 14-hour car ride with children in the back. If you haven't, I do not wish it upon you. But if you've ever experienced something like that, so you're like 45 minutes into the ride when that first question comes from the back. Are we almost there? Now, there's a tough question to answer because you're the parent. You know that you have 14 driving hours plus all the stops. It's like 17 more hours until you get there. And you have this question 45 minutes in. So you have a couple of options. You can either be honest and you can say, nope, it's about 16 hours and 15 minutes until we get there. You could try that. Or you could say something like, we're almost there. We're almost there. We're getting there. Or you can say something like, it's another hour and a half until we stop. Just an hour and a half until our next stop. That's where we're going. One more hour and a half, we're going to stop, we're going to get ice cream, and we'll run around a little bit, and then we'll continue. Because the child in the back can't grasp what 17 hours is like. And even if they could, I don't want to tell them that it's 17 more hours. So we like break it down. We're getting there, an hour and a half, we're going to stop. And there's like, this is Jewish history. It's like 2,000 years, and you're living in 1,200. Like, are you going to tell somebody living in 1,200? Yeah. It's going to happen in about the year 2100, so it's not going to be you or your children or your grandchildren. Like, that's not going to work. How does a nation that is b'chol yom achakelo, every day, I yearn, maybe it's today. So we're always trying to figure it out, and each one, like, maybe it'll be, you know, 1666 or 1724, and they have all these calculations as to why and what, and things are going on in the world, but the reality is we don't know. We yearn, we believe, we yearn, and we have no idea. And that's sort of, that's how it goes. So how will we know when the real one? We can talk about false messiahs all we like, but how are we going to know? How are we going to know? So how are you going to know it's Elio? How are you going to know? How are we going to know? So this is not so simple. The reality is, you know, one of the also great advantages of living out of town for many years of when I was in Atlanta, we were in the Bible Belt. So when I was the associate rabbi there, I would have classes, non-Jewish classes would come to shul twice a year, sometimes elementary school, high school, and divinity students. Because in the Bible Belt, they would actually go around to learn about other religions. And so my shul, Beth Jacob in Atlanta, became the stop for all of these Bible Belt schools to learn about Judaism. And they would regularly have like a week of religion, and they would go to all different things. And we were their Orthodox Jewish stop. We bring them into the shul, and they would just show them, like, there's so many, like, we take for granted. If you bring a non-Jew into a main sanctuary, there's so many things going on. So many things to talk about, the mechitza, the bima, the aron, the sifrei Torah, like the lights above. They're like all of these things that you don't even pay attention to. They have 1,000 questions. So I learned over the years to keep it out of all theology discussions and just focus on like basics of Judaism and a couple things around the shul. But there would always, invariably, in the last question and answer section, always, 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 it would be one student, sometimes it was a cute little sixth grader, sometimes it would be a divinity student who wanted a little bit more action, who would say, like, what's the Orthodox Jewish approach to Jesus? Always. It would happen all the time. And so I learned through trial and error how to very delicately answer that question without getting involved in anything more than they or I wanted to get involved in, which would basically be the Jewish approach is when Mashiach comes, there's going to be a basic checklist of the things that the person needs to do to prove that he's indeed Mashiach, like bringing us back to the land of Israel, rebuilding the base of Mikdash, creating world peace, certain things like along those lines that we have from different statements from the sages as here's your checklist, do all these things. And when you reestablish the Davidic dynasty and a monarchy with world peace and the Jews in Israel and a temple rebuilt, we'll know that you've succeeded. Don't tell me you're the Messiah. Do all these things and then you'll be the Messiah. And when Jesus came, we like looked at our checklist and we said, no. So you're not it. Like next. And sort of like, I didn't quite do it like that in front of them. But basically that's pretty much it. That's pretty much it. So then that's been, we had it like 1,500 years. Like, again, after Bar Kokhba, and we didn't have, and then as we get to the 1500s, we're going to have, as we'll read a couple of these stories now as we go through, where that sort of fell apart, that defense mechanism, that checklist. So let's start with David Haru Eveni. David Haru Eveni is in year 1523, appears for the first time. We don't know much about his background before then because he like appeared out of nowhere. And this is a world, this is going back 500 years, we don't have the records. He enters into the chaos and the crisis of post-Spanish Inquisition, which he spoke about at great length about 2 weeks ago. And remember, as we spoke then, the Spanish Inquisition did not end in 1492. That was the death of Spanish Jewry. But what it did is it exiled some 250,000 Spanish Jews and then an additional, I don't know if it was 50 to 100,000 Portuguese Jews 5 years later and basically picked them up from their lands and disperse them throughout the rest of the world. Total penniless, broken people who, again, as we mentioned then, if it wouldn't be for the Holocaust, we would still be talking about the Spanish Inquisition as the worst tragedy in Jewish history, based on just the numbers, the loss, the brokenness of the people, and now they're like all over. In addition to that, we have the Murano problem. We have the conversos, those who were pretending to be Christian and either are still pretending to be Christian or have now come back and have found a world that they don't recognize in terms of trying to find their way back. 1523 is only 30 years later. So it's the same generation. The generation that was exiled is not just their grandchildren. This is somebody who was 40 years old is now 70. Somebody who was in their 20s, they're 50 years old. And those who became conversos and remember what Shabbos and Yom Kippur is supposed to be like, and they're not doing any of it, this is the world, the chaos that he enters into. So his fellow David HaRuveni literally shows up in Cairo and introduces himself. I'm not making this up. You could look all of these things up. There's a lot of literature on it. He introduces himself basically as the ambassador of the king of the 10 lost tribes. He shows up and he says, I'm the ambassador. I represent the 10 lost tribes of the Jewish people. Now remember, the 10 lost tribes disappear at what point in Jewish history? But the first Beis HaMikdash, which was destroyed in the year 480 before the Common Era, we're now in the year 1500. We're talking nearly 2,000 years. And he shows up and he says, I represent this group of the 10 lost tribes. The historians describe him as a half mystic and a half adventurer. He's a charlatan, madman, genius, scholar, opportunist, hero, villain, and liar, all wrapped up into one. Complicated, you may know somebody like that, but he's a complicated person, and he claims that he's on a journey, shows up in Cairo, and he wants to meet the Pope. Why does he want need to meet the Pope in Rome? Because he, representing this Jewish group on the opposite side of the Sambatia River, which is where we have this tradition that the 10 lost tribes are, he has come from there, and he has this large army, and he wants to join together with the Pope to kick the Muslims out of Jerusalem, who had since come in after the Crusades. The Muslims eventually, after all that 300-year Crusade period, ended up in power. The Ottomans ended up in power. And he was going to help the Pope free Jerusalem. And he was going to make a partnership. He was going to open up the trade routes to the Christian control. That was why the Pope should join him. And the land of Israel should go back to Jewish control. Okay, that's what he claimed. That's what he wanted to do, in essence. And the reason why this became relevant and it took hold is because the second part of his platform was that in redeeming the land of Israel, all of the conversos would be welcome there and save them from this terrible limbo that they are in. Either they're in Portugal and Spain acting as Christians, or they've been dispersed throughout the land, and all of these Spanish and Portuguese refugees are still all over. I'm going to bring them home. I'm going to give them a place where they're going to be able to come back. And that point is really brings us back to box number 3, which is that when times are particularly tough, and there appears to be no human or rational solution other than the supernatural, Mashiach becomes a great option when you're stuck. When life has presented a scenario that has no answer. There's no solution. We're looking at one right now. Like, what's the solution to 2 million Palestinians living in Gaza? Like, what's the plan? Nobody has a plan. There is no plan. When you have no plan, the best solution to a planless situation is Mashiach. So that always brings up like holy spiritual Jews with the idea that Mashiach is going to come. When you have a national crisis like the size of that which the Spanish Inquisition was, that's a ripe people for Mashiach to come and salve. I've mentioned many times before, Rabbi Wein likes to say tongue-in-cheek. He says, you know, you want to know why Mashiach hasn't come? He says, I'll tell you why. Because every single problem that ever existed in the Jewish people, this Jewish people's solution is Mashiach will fix it. Oh, you got a problem? When Mashiach comes, he'll take care of that. This, Mashiach. So if you're Mashiach, would you want to come? Would you want to show up to a people that all they have is a laundry list of unsolvable problems? I wouldn't want to come. So, but that's sort of the reality. So he, this guy David HaRuveni, basically taps into this crisis of the Spanish Inquisition. And picks up on that. Now, he does not overtly claim messianic redemption, but it was impossible to separate. He shows up on a white horse and a golden carriage. He created a flag of the 10 tribes, and so he goes to Yerushalayim a year later. The next year, in 1524, he claims to perform all sorts of miracles. He got some magical rock from under the dome of the rock that was there, and the Jews believe him. Now, remember, there's no Google in 1524. Somebody shows up and says, I'm the Mashiach. You don't have the tools. In our world, we don't even realize it, but it's so obvious. If anyone today would come and claim to be Mashiach, anyone would make such a claim, we right away would throw him out and say, you've lost your mind. But even if we wanted to indulge him for a minute, the first thing we would do while we're talking to him, you know, people are doing that. Like, you say something, like, while you're, like, talking to him, they're already, you would Google the guy, like, what's his footprint? Where's he been? Where did he go to yeshiva? What approbations does he have? You can't just show up and claim to be Mashiach today. Like, what, you know, how many articles have you published? Where did you write? What sefer did? But you don't have any of that in 1524. You just have a guy who shows up and he claims that he is the Mashiach. Now, particularly the Muranos, the conversos, were very excited. And in one of the major quirks of history, he travels to Rome and creates enough of a stir around him that he actually gets an audience with the Pope. It's an astounding facet in history that the guy shows up, claims to be the Messiah, travels to Jerusalem, gathers some people, ends up in Rome, and actually meets with the Pope. Now, the Pope agrees. This is, after all, a guy claiming to have a large army, which, again, you never get away with today. They just make up claims of having such a large army. But he's claiming to retake Jerusalem, which the Pope would like to do, open up the trade routes and give it to the Christian world, which the Pope would like to do. So the Pope basically puts a couple of conditions on it, one of which was getting to the King of Portugal to join in. King of Portugal, remember, only 20 years, 25 years before, basically had his own inquisition together with Spain and kicked all of the Jews out. But now there's this major war going on between the German emperor and the French king, and the Pope wants the King of Portugal to play a role in getting rid of that war between the Germans and the French to join in, and he sends David Haruveni back to Portugal, where he goes to try to win the favor of the king. Now, remember, what's still going on in Portugal in the early 1520s? Inquisition is still going on. There is no Jew openly practicing in Portugal in this time. And this Jew rides into town with a letter from the Pope that he's there to meet with the king to get him, together with him, to kick out the Muslims from the Holy Land. The Muranos come out like magnets. This guy rides in. Try to put yourself in, you know, these... It's 25 years they've been hiding. And all of a sudden, fellow rides in his white horse with a letter from the Pope that he's meeting with the king and they're going to redeem Jerusalem. They come out like magnets because this is it. The redemption has happened. This did not go over well with the Inquisition. And they exile him. And I'm sure it was not good for any of those... the conversos who revealed themselves. On his way out, he meets up with a fellow named Diego Perez, who was a Murano himself, who takes on the name Shlomo Molcho. This fellow, Diego Perez, was a brilliant fellow himself. He actually became a secretary to the king at a very young age, a king of Portugal by age 20. And he decides that this is true, that this guy, David Haruveni, is the real deal. He himself is very unsatisfied with Christianity. He himself was born. He was born as a Christian already to a Murano family. And he teaches himself Gemara, Kabbalah, ends up meeting together with this David Haruveni, defines himself as a redeemed soul. And they share this messianic vision. And they travel. They travel all over the place, from Portugal to Italy to Germany. And they create a messianic fervor. Legends are he predicted the earthquakes and floods and wars that ravaged Europe in 1532. If you look online, his Wikipedia page, like he predicted to the Pope this one, and he predicted to the King of this that one. And he took on a name, the Shlomo Molcho, as a holy man and a miracle worker. Meanwhile, as the story goes, they made it to the German Empire, and the Holy Roman Emperor Charles V basically had enough of their trying to gather Jews and basically crucifies both of them. Shlomo is burnt at the stake, and they kill off in one way or another David Haruveni. And that seems almost like the end of the story. Shlomo Molcho himself dies a martyr's death. The legend is that he was given the choice to return back to Christianity, from which again he was born. And he said, "I'd rather die a martyr. I'm not going back." And he was burned at the stake. No one less than Rabbi Yosef Cairo, the Mechaber, the author of the Shulchan Aruch, writes in one of his works that he should only be so privileged to die the death of Shlomo Molcho, this martyr. Historically, over the years, the historians have moved him, Shlomo Molcho, far out of the category of a martyr into a false messiah category. One of the books was published in Israel recently, and they listed all the false messiahs in Jewish history, and they listed him, and it created a whole stir. He was a false messiah, he was really a martyr, he never claimed to be the Mashiach, but the two of these people, David Haruveni, Shlomo Molcho, are names that began this process. They had a big following because of the times that they lived in, and it was not clear. Shlomo Molcho, by the way, just an interesting historical note, was put to death, Jewish legend has it, on the 5th of Tevis, which was just yesterday, in 1532. In any case, they're like the appetizer for our story, that already in the 1500s, because of what was going on in the world, the conditions were such that allowed for such a story to take place. We're going to fast forward about 100 years, to the mid-1600s, middle of the 17th century, is our next major false messiah player, and that, of course, is the very famous Shabtai Tzvi. This name is very, very famous in amongst the Jewish people, whether his actual story is as known, less so, but like the name Shabtai Tzvi, that has made its way in. The context for Shabtai Tzvi, similar to David HaRuveni, which was the disaster of the Spanish Inquisition, is the Chilmaniki uprising of 1648 and 1649. This uprising in the Ukraine, which was really not about the Jews, but the Jews were caught in the middle. Ukraine at that time had been was really taken over by the Polish landlords. They were the ones controlling everything, and the Ukrainian peasants, led by this fellow named Bogdan Chilmaniki, basically have an uprising against the Polish lords who are controlling Ukraine, and they rebel against them. The Jews are caught in the middle. The Jews are always caught in the middle. They were the middlemen in this particular thing because the Polish lords often had the Jews as the tax collectors or giving the money on interest. So, and they were slaughtered. It was, if it wouldn't have been for the Holocaust and it wouldn't have been for the Spanish Inquisition, the Chilmaniki uprising would be the worst disaster in estimates are somewhere between 100,000 and 200,000 Jews are slaughtered. Now, the Jewish population at the time was estimated between 2 and 2.5 million. So you're talking somewhere between 7 to 10% of the entire Jewish people are slaughtered within a 2 to 3 year period. And I use the word slaughtered because the descriptions that we have are nothing less than a slaughter. This was not a mass murder. It was literal Cossacks, Ukrainian mobs going into Jewish towns and just absolutely slaughtering. There's a lot of literature on it. We say Kinos on Tisha B'Av. The descriptions are horrific. And many of the survivors, again, when you talk about that number, Ukraine is in the news now, and Jews who know history, when this war broke out between Russia and the Ukrainians, like, just because Putin was bad didn't make Ukraine good. Ukraine flows with Jewish blood throughout 400 years from the Chilmaniki uprising through the Holocaust. Was not a good place. For the Jews. And this particular time is known as Tach V'Tat, because the year 1648 was Tav Ches, like right now it's Tav Shin Pei Dalet. That was Tav Ches, and 1649 was Tav Tet. So it's known as Tach V'Tat. Those are the years of this terrible decimation of the Jewish people. And many of the survivors, so they fled. So in the same way as the Spanish Inquisition not only destroyed a significant population living in Spain and Portugal, but it uprooted the survivors and then dispersed them, broken people, throughout the rest of the Jewish world. So this did the same thing to the Ashkenazi world of Ukraine in these years. This time period is also filled with what was known as imminent redemption. The Christian world, for some reason, also, there was many predictions of apocalyptic years, of redemptive years. It was like, it was in the air that this was a time that was going to be a big thing. 1648 was a year that was known to the Jews based on a computation of the Zohar, but it ended up being a terrible year. 1640 was not a year of redemption. And into this literal year, in the year 1648, Shabtai Tzvi reveals himself. Now, he is a person who was very charismatic and a spiritual person who was very drawn to Kabbalah. He was a very bright, brilliant person, and he was into Kabbalah. The Arizal's Kabbalah was not very long on the scene at this point, but he became a student of that, and particularly the Arizal's Kabbalah, which we'll talk about at length in a different time, but for now was a lot about finding the nugget, the spark of sanctity, of Kedusha, even in everyday things. And especially if you have in a horrible time period, of finding the spark, literally the nugget of Kedusha. And he becomes a holy man. Very many aesthetic practices, a lot of fasting, immersing in the mikveh all the time. I have the Jewish Encyclopedia reports that he was actually married twice. And both of his wives requested and then were granted divorces because he refused to engage in regular married life with them. He was a mystic, he was an aesthetic, and he wanted nothing to do with this world. The problem is, he also suffered from what we would define today as manic depression. And he went, vacillated, again, this was not known, there was no terminology for that in those days, from periods of unbelievable energy and grandeur and charm and charisma, and then into deep, depressive periods of total isolation and depression, visions of demons and fantasies. And he couched it. He would couch this in Kabbalistic terms, in which he had periods of illumination, in which God was close and spoke to him and gave him visions, and then periods of Hester upon him, in which Hashem's face was hidden from him, and he was bin choshech, and in the dark. And see, he couched, again, what we would identify in our regular terminology, he was manic depressive, he had these bouts. He put it in these very Kabbalistic terms. And at the ripe old age of 22, in 1648, he declares himself the leader of the Jewish people to a small group of followers in his hometown of Smyrna, Turkey. So he was a charismatic person, and he was well-versed. He was a Kabbalist, and he was a holy man. He was an aesthetic. And in 1648, in the midst of this horrible time for the Jewish people, he declares himself to be, he's the leader of the Jewish people. Now, the rabbis of this town, you know, they tolerate, you know, he was there, they grew up, you know, this is Shabtai Tzvi. And at a certain point, they just said, like, enough. And so they banish him. Put him in the chayim, kick him out of town. Now, in 1648, unlike today, where there's an internet, and you get banished and put in chayim, so, you know, everybody knows. So in 1648, they kick you out of town. What do? You pack up your bags, you get on the next little caravan to the next town, or two towns over, or if you're really ambitious, three towns over, and you set up shop. They have to really not like you in the new town to like send messengers back to the old one to find out, like, what's the deal? And so that's in essence what happens. We don't have the full list of places that he went. We only have the places which issued a cheirim against him. So we know that there was an actual cheirim in Smyrna, in Constantine, in Salonika, in Cairo. All of those stops we know of, that because of his eccentricity and the things that he was doing, which was so bizarre and neged halacha, they actually banished him. But there were several other stops along the way that they just never got so bad to actually to banish him. What was he doing? So he is this holy man, believing that he's the leader of the Jewish people and going to create this messianic return to the land, started doing all sorts of things. Number one, he started proclaiming the fast days, which commemorate the destructions, are now feast days. We don't need an Asara B'Tavis anymore coming up this Friday. We don't need it because it commemorates the destruction. But I'm here. I'm here. I'm going to redeem the Jewish people. I'm going to bring them back to the land. So it's no longer a fast day. Tisha B'Av, no longer a fast day. We don't need any of these days. He held a wedding between himself, the Ein Sof, he called himself, and the Torah. Like an actual wedding. He invited friends and had a band and a feast, stood under the chuppah with the Sefer Torah, representing the Jewish people and its marriage to the Torah. He started pronouncing the name of Hashem when he would make brachas. We don't pronounce the name of Hashem. Even though it's spelled with a yud and a hey and a vav and hey, we never pronounce that name. The Kohen Gadol would pronounce that name in the Kodesh HaKadoshim on Yom Kippur. But we don't pronounce that name. We pronounce it as Ado and then Noi. But that's how we say. Even by Yom HaHu, in that day when there'll be a redemption, Yihyeh Hashem Echad Ushemo Echad. Then his name and he will be the same. We'll pronounce that name again. So he started doing that. He started making brachos and pronouncing Hashem's name. This was, and then he introduced a whole series of new laws of sexual immorality because things were changing. There was one of these aspects was there was a young orphan named Sarah from the Ukraine. His parents were slaughtered in the Tach V'Tat uprising, and she was taken into a Christian like home, raised as a Christian, and then took to the streets. When she was 16, she escaped or left, whatever, and was a prostitute. And then she began having visions that she was going to marry the Messiah. This is true stuff. This is, you could look this up. She started having visions that she's going to marry the Messiah. Word gets to Shabtai Tzvi, who's going around saying that he is the Messiah, and he says, "It's a shidduch. This is a shidduch." And they get married. They get married. And this becomes part of his redemption, of redeeming that which seems to be so low and removed from holiness. But in the Messianic era, it's okay. So he's going to salvage a prostitute, orphan, and she's going to marry Mashiach. Now, this has roots. Yehuda and Tamar, David and Bathsheba, there's Lot and his daughter, there are roots of Mashiach in what we would consider a promiscuous or inappropriate behavior. So picking up on that theme, he does the same thing and claims that this, all the things that were previously forbidden are all going to become permitted because Mashiach has arrived. Which brings us to box number, whatever that is, 4. And that is Kabbalah, of which I know very little. Outside of the Rambam, by many, by many. We're getting there. With the exception of the Rambam, the Messianic era is assumed to be an exceptionally miraculous and mystical time. Meaning, the Rambam holds when Mashiach comes, it's going to be the same business as usual. Just that we won't have to deal with the non-Jews who are trying to stop us from serving and living as we want. But everybody besides for the Rambam understands when Mashiach comes, it's going to be miraculous. Things are going to be totally, totally different. And therefore, with our rational minds, if you say it's going to be different, it's going to be miraculous, well, what does it look like? What will life actually look like in these miraculous times? I don't know. Well, what if somebody comes and says, I know, this is what it's going to look like. Because Kabbalah at its core, without getting into any of the details, is saying life is far deeper than what it seems on the surface. On the surface, you see this. But what's going on underneath is something else. And Kabbalah is all about understanding and looking deeper than simply what meets the eye, like a world mask. Learning to read the signs on the outside as to what it actually means. And there are many parables and paradigms that we use for that. You look at a person's face and you see a muscle twitch, but that means that they're really happy. Because we've learned to understand that. The muscle twitch that we see on the outside of a person's face expresses something deep inside. So the whole world is like that. You just have to learn to read the world that when you see this, it doesn't mean muscles twitched. It means something far deeper. So he came and he said, I'll tell you, all the things that used to be forbidden, that was because we lived in a non-redeemed world. Now that we're going to be redeemed, all of these things are going to be okay. Now, if it were just this, he would have gone to the dustbin of history, most likely as a crazy man who had all sorts of wacky things. He was banned everywhere that he went. He went against all normative halacha with the fast days, with the names of Hashem, his wedding. He was an eclectic, out of the box, and he would have most likely been forgotten to history. Except for the fact that he runs into a fellow named Nathan of Gaza. The Jews were in Gaza for a long, long time. So Nathan in Gaza, just a parenthetical comment. Nathan of Gaza is the John the Baptist, if you will, of Shabtai Tzvi. He is the PR guy. He was a Sephardi, and he is taken by this Shabtai Tzvi and his messianic claims and his visions of grandeur. And when he was manic, he was this most charismatic person who felt he was going to save the entire Jewish world. And even though Shabtai Tzvi might have not been able to do this, but Nathan of Gaza has a golden pen. And he begins to write letters. And he goes on a massive letter-writing campaign and sends letters to communities, Jewish communities throughout the world, proclaiming that the Mashiach has come, that this fellow Shabtai Tzvi, this Kabbalist, this ascetic, this holy man has indeed arrived, and now is the time. Yeah.
Is he Jewish?
Yes. Yeah. Natan from Aza. He throws the entire Jewish world into an ecstasy. Remember, we're 100, 200 years post-Spanish Inquisition. It's Tach V'Tat. And Mashiach has come. We've been waiting. We've been yearning. And a letter comes. Now, it's hard for us again in our modern day world. Let's just go through this exercise to put yourself into position. Again, today, if you were to get a letter in the mail that said the Messiah has come, so if you wanted a good laugh, you would read it. If not, you would just throw it away. But just try to imagine it's in the 1650s. And you get a handwritten letter from a fellow named Nathan of Gaza telling you that Shabtai Tzvi, this holy man, Mashiach has come, and the Jewish people are going to be redeemed. It's here. It's come. How should you react? So you get a letter like that, and then you go to your Rav, and the Rav says, I got the same letter. I don't know. I never met this guy Shabtai Tzvi. But what happens is, you now start getting rumors, like people traveling, people saying, I saw, I heard, and there's like this avalanche in an environment ripe for it of rumors, stories, legends. I heard he did this. I heard he did that. And when you combine that with the deep desire to solve the problem of the Jewish exile, and here's a solution, it gets a lot of traction. I remember when I was in fourth grade, and I remember very clearly in New Jersey, I remember we were going through the Siddur, and we must have gone through like Tekab Shofar Gadol Cheruseinu, and our Rebbe was teaching us about this call of the Shofar, Mashiach coming. I remember asking my Rebbe the question of, how will I know when Mashiach comes? Like, I was nervous. I was a little boy in Highland Park. I'm in a small little town in Highland Park, New Jersey. Not like the Five Towns. How am I going to know in Highland Park if Mashiach comes? Like, maybe he's going to come, and all the Five Towns people are going to go to Israel, and I'm not going to find out. How will I know? I remember asking the question of like, am I going to hear a shofar? What is it going to be like? And the amazing thing about that question is that no one will ever, ever, ever ask that question again in the history of the world. Because in whatever year that was, in 1984, 1980, there was no internet. So, but today, will anyone ever ask the question of like, how will I know? I mean, how will you know? There's not a piece of important information that happens in the world, even not important information that happens in the world, that the whole world doesn't know about instantaneously. If Mashiach comes, we're going to find out. Don't worry about it. Like, that's not a question that we have of how will I know? But in the 1600s, that's a real, like, how are you going to know? Well, what happens if a letter shows up? Maybe it's going to be a letter. A letter comes claiming that this is it. Now, that brings us to box number 5, which is a very important box. Even if you don't believe that this is going to be, there's no way, this just doesn't make any sense, it doesn't feel right, but it's beginning to spread, and people are talking, and people are saying, I heard he did this, I heard he did that, I heard we're going to Eretz Yisrael, get ready. You don't want to be the one on the wrong side of Mashiach. What if it's right? And you were the guy who said, no, it's not true. I don't want to be caught being the guy going against it. So as this groundswell of energy begins to follow Shabtai Tzvi and his golden pen author around all these communities, and you know, you're hearing from your cousin, they heard, and they got a letter, and this one got excited. I don't want to be the one to say it's not true. So there's like, everyone's a little hesitant. Everyone is a little hesitant, and the Jewish world is thrown into both panic, confusion, and ecstasy all in once, trying to figure out what in the world to do. So meanwhile, Shabtai Tzvi, this is going around, he goes to Yerushalayim, he and his wife and Nathan of Gaza, and they get banished from there. The rabbis there throw them out. Now there's only a small Jewish community in Yerushalayim, but they don't want anything to do with this guy in Yerushalayim, telling them not to fast on Tisha B'Av, looking at the ruins, looking at a mosque, and like, you're not going to fast on Tisha B'Av, and there's not going to fast on Sabbath day. We're still, so they throw him out. He then goes to Turkey, which is a move of great audacity, because the Sultan was actually in charge of the land of Israel at the time, and he's claiming that he's going to redeem it and bring all the Jews back there. And for a few years, the Sultan allows it. As Rabbi Wein likes to say, it was good for business. Shabtai Tzvi was in Turkey. All the Jews from all over were checking it out, trying to come to meet with him. So it was like a constant tourist attraction. But then Shabtai Tzvi announces that he's going to raise an army. He's going to retake Yerushalayim, destroy the mosque, and rebuild the temple. And the Sultan says, whoa, that's my hometown. You can't do that. So he arrests him. The Sultan arrests Shabtai Tzvi now that he's claiming to, he's going to raise an army and take over the temple. But it's a light, like, house arrest. And Nathan continues penning letters saying, now is the test. Now that he's been arrested, now that there's been a bump in the road, now is the test to see if you believe in the coming of the Mashiach. Which brings us to point number six. The Gemara has a concept that it references once, but the Midrashim speak more of, and that is Mashiach ben Yosef preceding Mashiach ben David. It is not spoken about at length. One time it's referenced in Masechta Sukkah in the Gemara, that there'll be a character, a Mashiach, not ben David, but ben Yosef. And that Mashiach ben Yosef is going to precede Mashiach ben David and fail. We'll wage a war, and will be killed in that war, but that will pave the path, get the people ready for the coming of Mashiach ben David. Now, there's a lot more rabbinic literature and Kabbalistic literature as to what to make of this Mashiach ben Yosef. What will that look like? But what it does is creates a tremendous amount of ambiguity and the potential that when the process gets started, it will actually fail at first until it succeeds. Once that was introduced, what the Gemara talks about, this concept of Mashiach ben Yosef first, and then Mashiach ben Yosef is going to die at war, and then Mashiach ben David is going to come. So now, anytime somebody comes and claims to be Mashiach, and then it fails, there's always that, you could still say, aha, this is not a problem. Do not be fooled by the failure. This is actually just the Mashiach ben Yosef proceeding, and now is your test whether or not you'll be able to look past the failing in front of us and realize that this is really still on the path of where it is that we want it to go. That concept of a failed Mashiach allows for what would otherwise clearly be like, this can't be it. And then it allows it, well, maybe it still is. The Jewish world is in total and utter confusion. It's hard to describe. It is estimated that up to a third of the Jewish world believed him. Believed that Mashiach was coming. Like significant rabbanim, rabbis of communities. They thought this was it. They thought that this was it. Now again, remember, out of that third of the Jewish people, probably a minuscule percentage actually ever laid eyes on the man. If you didn't live in one of those towns and you weren't in the city where he came and visited in one of his stops, you just heard. There was a tumult. And again, we're in an era of the mid-1600s. Rabbi Yaakov Sesportis was the major antagonist to all of this. And he wrote a sefer on all of these events. And he describes that what was going on in the Jewish community, there were brachos added in shul in his honor. Like we say tefillahs. We added tefillahs like for the Medina, for the Chayalim. We add tefillahs for the Shvuim. And it's like, yeah, across the whole world, everyone's adding these tefillahs. In the 1600s, they were adding tefillahs for the coming of Shabtai Tzvi, Moshian Shel Yisrael, the Mashiach is here. And they were davening in shuls, they were adding brachos because of them. There were shuls that held feasts on Yom Kippur, because Shabtai Tzvi declared, it's a new world. Mashiach, Messianic era, we don't need, not just the minor fast days of the rabbinic origins, we don't need these things. And then you end up with this situation in which people begin actually getting ready to go. They start selling businesses. They start selling their homes. It's this fervor of, we're going. It's time to go. And the Dust East Indies Company, there are registered complaints that we have that they could not find ships for their business because the Jews were buying, selling their homes, selling their businesses, and getting ready to go. There were pogroms. We have records of pogroms. This is like the Purim story. The Jews, after several hundred years of merciless persecution at the hands of the Christians, began, all of a sudden, it's like, aha, literally the Purim story. Now we're going home. And there were pogroms that break out, Jews attacking their Christian neighbors. And you have to remember, if you're living in a Christian world, which most of the Ashkenazi Jewish world was at the time, this whole idea of a Mashiach and a redemption of the Jewish people is not just a small thing. This is cutting to the core of the host country in which you live, their belief system that says Mashiach already came and you're no longer the chosen people. This idea is literally in their faces saying, like, you're wrong, we're right. Now, we believe that. But this was the wrong time and in the wrong place and your wrong hosts to do all of that. But that's what was going on. And it's hard for us to imagine. I mean, I guess it's not so hard. I guess, you know, we do it on our own. We're living in a crazy time right now. So what would be if there would be, I guess, hard to, like, what would be the call? Like some call from, a leading chief rabbi of Eretz Yisrael, like people just started selling their homes. So you're like, what do you do? Do I stay here? Everybody's leaving. You know, once 5 people sell their homes and businesses, 10 people, 30 people in your community. Let's say you're in a small shtetl in Turkey out of 150 Jewish families, and 30 sell their homes. I'm going to be left behind? Should I sell while I can still get something? It just created such a panic amongst the Jewish people. Rabbi Yaakov Sasportz is, again, this antagonist who was yelling and screaming the whole time, writes a fantastic letter. This is one of the, I've asked this, you know, like there's like a Friday night question to ask. He writes a letter to Rabbi Yitzchak Abuav, and he says, why are you letting this go? Rabbi Yitzchak Abuav was like into it, and he was, participating in the tefillas and the brachas and everything. And Rabbi Yaakov Sasportis writes him and says, how could you not stop this? How are you letting this go on? This is not true. Guy's a charlatan. He's against all normative halacha. We have no record that this is the way that it's going to look. And this is not good. Why are you letting this to continue? And Rabbi Yitzchak Abuav writes back. He says, why didn't I stop this? This was so good for the Jews. He says, my shul is packed. People are excited. People are coming. There's an energy in the shul. Everybody wants to hear the drasha. Everybody wants to be part of it. I've had Jews who haven't come to shul in years. They're coming. I should stand up and say, nothing to see here. It's a farce. It's not true. We're not going home. Come anyway. Not going to happen. All these Jews are so excited. They're so excited. I'm not going to tell them it's not true. In hindsight, it's such a conundrum. And he let it go because the shuls are packed. Shuls are packed. Of course, the problem is, when it all collapsed, the Sultan eventually had enough. And the Sultan basically calls in Shabtai Tzvi and says, enough of this. Either you convert to be an Islam, a Muslim, or I'm going to kill you. This is in 1666. This is like 15 years or so after he starts on this whole path. And Shabtai Tzvi converts. That's it. He takes off his Jewish garb, puts on his Muslim clothing. He takes an additional Muslim wife and he becomes an officer in the Sultan's court. Just like that. Nathan of Gaza, not to be deterred, sends letters out saying, now is the real test. When it looks like the Mashiach has converted to Islam, now is the test to see whether or not you are a true believer in the coming of the Mashiach. And but that's basically the end. Shabtai Tzvi pretends to be a little bit both a Muslim and Jew. Eventually he's banished and he dies a very lonely and isolated death without any major following in 1676, 10 years after he originally converts. There are 300 Jewish families that converted with him. That when he converted, they all said, like, well, if Mashiach is converting, this is what we're supposed to do. 300 families convert. They became known as the, I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing this right, the Danmei group. They were a group of Muslims who were converted Jews who all converted with Shabtai Tzvi. They maintained their identity for another 200 years as this unique community. And one would think that this was the end of the story. Except the story continues for another 100 years, a full century later, in which the fallout really lasts on two levels. Number one, the fallout, which Mirtzah will discuss next lesson. I'm going to be in Eretz Yisrael next month, so it won't be next Monday. The fallout of the people's disillusionment with rabbinic leadership that allowed... imagine you sold your house. Imagine you sold your business. Imagine you were part of a pogrom against the Christian neighbors, and all of a sudden it's like, uh-oh, he just converted to Islam, and then the whole thing dies out. But your world has collapsed. The fervor, the excitement. And all of a sudden, the rabbis are left giving a drasha the next week saying, he converted to Islam. It's all over. All of that years of excitement, of it's coming, it's here. So there is a tremendous amount of fallout. Tremendous amount of fallout. Kabbalah takes a huge hit. Kabbalah goes underground because that was really one of the driving forces. It only goes underground for a short while because eventually it's going to explode in a new form, and that's going to be Chassidus. That will happen as well. And the Shabtai Tzvi phenomena, somehow, in an astounding element of the stiff-neckedness of the Jewish people, remains for another century, in which the Sabbatean movement, this belief that he indeed was the Mashiach, continues for 100 years. We're going to have more stories. Yaakov Frank will be our next false Messiah. The Yaakov Emden, Rav Yonasan Eibeshitz controversy is all about trying to find people who still are claiming that he's the Mashiach, and them saying, I don't believe it, I do believe it, he actually is the Mashiach. This will embroil the Jewish community for another 100 years in the fallout of picking up the pieces of this. The relevance for us are the historical truths of the things, the environment that allows for people, just tying up from where we started, the belief that there will be a Mashiach, the belief that I yearn for Mashiach, I don't know when it's going to come, and because of these things, these traumas, we stop talking about Mashiach. We don't talk about it. One would think that if one of the questions that is going to be asked of each of us is, did you yearn for Mashiach? We should talk about it more. We should talk about Mashiach. But there's a great hesitancy. If you talk about Mashiach, a lot of people will say, Chabad. Anyone outside of Chabad, if you talk about Mashiach, like, why? We don't talk about it. There's such a national trauma. Even though this is part of our people. We have to believe in it. We have to believe it's coming. We have to yearn for it. Every day. B'chol yom v'yom machakelo. I wait, I yearn. But there's like, we're like, anyone today would claim, like, we don't take it seriously. We're traumatized. And it continues. It continued for many, many years. And the environment of trauma always brings it up. You hear it colloquially all the time. Every time something goes on in the world, in Eretz Yisrael, a trauma, you always will hear people saying, oh, Mashiach is coming. This one is it. It's around the corner. It was there in 67, in 73, 91. I remember with the scuds already. Like, always. Always. And v'chol yom v'yom, machakala, every day we wait, we yearn. When it will happen, as I spoke about Friday night, it's keherifying. Just when you think it's not going to happen, like in a keherifying, in a flash, it will happen. Redemption will happen. But this is part of the story of this great controversy that erupted amongst the Jewish people, which we really just scratched the surface for. You can look up, again, the lots of stories on David HaRuveni and on Shabtai Tzvi. And Mirat Hashem will cover Yaakov Frank and the Yaakov Emden Eibeshitz controversy, Mirat Hashem, in a future class. Wishing everybody a wonderful night.